across all of BPA, whether it's transmission or power or energy efficiency, in this case, demand response and energy storage. And we'll continue to do that. We want to evaluate DR potential new technology and loads of significant interest to the region. We do have 8 new DR-related projects in this fiscal year. Data centers, some might argue it's the only test of this kind in the nation. I know that California, again, has done some pretty good work at the UC Berkeley and UCSD. But we think we have a pretty good approach. And asked yesterday, what about data centers? How do they play in DR? It's essentially shifting the load, the computing load, from one data center to the other. And that has huge impacts, tens of megawatts of impacts on individual, potentially, of load. Heat pump water heaters, a new area for us. We've worked extensively in the traditional electric resistance water heat. We think there's potential in heat pump water heaters. Municipal wastewater treatment, energy storage, and I talked a little bit about this yesterday if you happen to be at that symposium. So we are developing the focus for next year's TI portfolio. That will come out in a couple of weeks. And just as a reminder, a little advertisement for Terry Oliver and his TI program, that there will be a solicitation, I think comes out at the end of March, is due by the end of March. I could have that wrong. If you're interested, this is a yearly process. It is a 50% cost share, and in fact, these are 50% cost share projects that we're moving forward and testing these new technologies. So I'd recommend, if you're interested in that, please check out the website. Or if you need some help doing that, just give us a call. So again, a little bit of the TI program, and I'm not going to go through all of these, but these are the technologies that we have not tested extensively in the DR space. We're continuing battery storage and new technologies there. Heat pump water heaters are very interesting to us because we haven't tested them yet. And heat pump water heaters are on the rise. I mean, they are part of the energy efficiency plan that's been endorsed by the council and have a lot of potential. But can we also use the potential for demand response? So this is the next prong, if you will. The DR business plan, we call it the DR commercial demonstration projects. How to move from small number of small capacity, hundreds of kilowatts, utility focus, and move toward commercial arrangements that will really be able to be at significant megawatts, if you will, that we can then use to as a platform for moving forward with a DR program in general. So we want to, in fact, just a week ago today, we had a workshop with utilities to talk about this approach. Now, the approach is simply, how do we move from technology proof of concept projects to now getting into commercial arrangements where we have all the attributes that we've heard about today, the frequency of use, how long to be used, the cost allocation, the cost piece of it, how much are we willing to pay for a particular service, and there's three goals of this. I want to just from the outset, the goal is at the end of this to have commercially viable products that we can expand later on. So it's a kind of a building block approach, commercially viable products in a framework that we can repeat over and over and over again. So this is just like any kind of power contract or capacity contract, but how you use this to how you develop this new contract, if you will. And that takes a lot of work at a place like BPA or any organization, how you develop that framework. The second piece is to how do you then use that to be dispatchable from the utility and dispatchable from BPA with using this common platform. And that's, we also have a track there. So it's dispatchability at operationally meaningful load levels for ancillary services or for the utility for peak load management. And then the third one is, and this gets into the cost allocation, how do we inform rate-making processes in the future to say how do we allocate those costs among the BPA rates? So the basic three areas, if you will, are the VERBS rate, which is the wind integration rate, secondly, the power rate, and then third, the transmission rate. If we're using them for different purposes, how does one allocate those costs? And this is at a scale that is small enough that we don't have to worry about that quite yet, but it'll inform the rate-making process downstream. So, again, the framework for the commercial arrangements, very important, dispatchability to prove that platform and to prove and how we can share a resource, and then third, to inform rate-making process downstream. And I would like to emphasize this last one. The leverage is strong working relationships that we believe we have with utilities and other stakeholders to move this forward, and we've started that process. Okay. So the we'd like to focus on the areas most likely near-term needs, which we've talked about before, transmission congestion, power system peaks, balance reserves, and potentially oversupply or supply management issue. And as I said, these are objectives, but I talked about the products or what we expect to end up with. The best commercial arrangements, evaluate dispatch, operation meaningful scale, and do it so that we can inform the rate making process downstream. This demonstration phase, just to again set this up, just a week ago today on February 7th, we had our kickoff meeting, a workshop with a lot of utilities. We had about 70 folks there here at BPA in Portland and on the phone. And our first ask was, who is interested? And we got a lot of feedback from that. So the joint approach is working with utilities and regional groups to identify, design, and implement these projects. They are not pilots for technical demonstration. They are pilots for commercial demonstration. And we really prefer to call them projects. A mix of partners, and we want to hear from utilities. We'd like to hear from others, too, about what is the optimum partner mix? The utilities, load following, and slice within and outside the BA each have their own, shall we say, complications. We would like to think that we might involve a DR aggregator, but we also want to, and as our first step, ask utilities what is the reaction to how would they like to involve or do they want to involve an aggregator? And then we've already had some pretty positive discussions about that, and we want to hear what are the other ideas. The cost allocation to split the cost between a utility and BPA or utility and other parties really has to be worked out. From the expected benefits, which each utility or set of utilities contributing in that contractual relationship based on the benefits that they expect to get. The scale, we've talked a little bit about this, the meaningful scale that'll mean something to our transmission and power operators. Ideally 4 to 6 projects, and I say ideally it could be 1 or 2, it could be 5 or 6. Kind of depends on the mix and the reaction we get, the response that we get, and that doesn't include, again, the technology innovation and the other projects. Again, those are research projects. We want to test multiple DR products and uses, the different acquisition methods, test in different geographies, because they're different. And when I say geographies, I mean, is there a non-wires or transmission limited area that might be very meaningful. We want to do it with different load types to manage the cost of operations. In fact, this sounds pretty broad, but again, we want to make it cost effective for utilities and BPA, and again, BPA on behalf of all our customers. And just in terms of dollars, we have about $3.2 million allocated for each, 14 and 15. And we're thinking contract length up to about 3 years, but these are just general parameters. It could be less, it could be a little bit more, but nominally 3 years. And we understand the pressing issue for utilities and others. Well, if I make an investment, I would like to see a longer-term payback from that. But at least in terms of the next steps, we think 3 years would probably be about the place we want to be. So, again, we're going from proof-of-concept pilots to continuing that technology innovation, research and development, but also now leveraging what we've learned and going into those commercial demonstrations, which will be somewhere between, we think, 50 and 100 megawatts of load. And that's a pretty broad range. Could or may not involve an aggregator. We want to talk to utilities about that. What's the receptivity and how might that work out? And you know, that we think we estimate will cost about $3.2 million per year for the next couple of years. These are the four potential DR products. We call them products, but equally call it use. And the BPA benefits and utility benefits you can read. For capacity, balance reserves, generation oversupply, and a potential peak load reduction for non-wires purposes. These probably are don't bear reading, because they're pretty obvious, or at least I think they are. Balancing reserves, we really do want to say, how does BPA benefit on behalf of all our customers to keep rates as low as reasonably achievable? And then from a utility standpoint, what are their benefits? We think that they can, again, if for their customers and for themselves, how do we have that revenue stream that will provide incentives to invest in demand response and then lower their overall costs just by providing that revenue stream? One thing, I just lost my thought. Actually, what I want to say is we mislabeled the slide and we haven't fixed it yet. The ink is within hour load increase. That's not quite right. Ink is really a generation term. It's within hour load decrease. So we need to fix that slide. So sorry about that. Ink and DECs. We talk about inks and DECs in the industry. And it really applies to generation. And that's the term we use consistently because we don't want to switch terms. So we have mislabeled this. Ink is a within hour load decrease, actually, or reduction. And it's because it's a generation term. But we try to be consistent with our transmission and power friends. So the different approaches we've thought about, and we've gotten some feedback about already, and we tested this with utilities. We're going to continue to test this with utilities, and we'll talk about the timeline, I think, in the next slide or two. But how might, for a single utility model, might it be that a utility designs and implements a DR commercial demonstration project in your own service territory? In fact, we've already embarked on that with the City of Port Angeles, leveraging what we learned in the pilot phase. So now how do we leverage those, not only those learnings, but the technology has already been installed, and we're in negotiations with them right now talking about how do we set up that contract. So we're actually moving ahead with the City of Port Angeles, and we'll look for more partners like that. A group of utilities model, maybe a PNGC or other set of utilities come together. It could be implemented by itself or a third party. A third party is nominally an aggregator. And we want to explore that with utilities. Are they interested in that? Maybe join a BPA-coordinated team of utilities to evaluate and select a DR aggregator for a DR commercial demonstration project across lots of service territories. And there might be other models here, too. We ask for that kind of feedback to say, are there other ideas? But these kind of three basic approaches, this is what comes under the term as acquisition methods. How do you acquire that demand response for an ancillary service and other purposes? This is the outreach and engagement. We're already embarked on the all-utility meeting last week, and we're working with others. Continue discussion with PNGC, Northwest Requirements Utilities, and so on, and assess that interest in using DR aggregators. But I don't want to emphasize or overemphasize DR aggregation or DR by a third party. We want to explore what are those opportunities. And, in fact, we've already embarked on a utility model, as I mentioned, with the City of Port Angeles. We think a terrific partner and already proven that in the pilot phase. And then we want to continue education for interested utilities, and that includes this meeting today. And this is part of our plan to move ahead, and we'll get this on the website for folks who are interested. And then those interested utility meetings now do more of a deep dive. Individually with utilities, assess benefits and cost allocation. Is there aggregator involvement or not? And then eventually get to a DR portfolio, which we think in the next 6 months we can achieve so that by the beginning of next fiscal year we can start those projects. And within those commercial arrangements, coinciding with the development of an a DR management system platform, which we've already started with Alstom Grid, formerly UISOL, and how to bring that all together in the next two fiscal years. So the project portfolio is not just, okay, you got three or four projects. It includes all these attributes, the number of megawatts, who are the partners, the aggregator role or not, expected benefits, what are the budgets, and how are those allocated between the utility and BPA, the funding plan, the governance, evaluation, and so on. And we do want to evaluate that. Remember, the third goal, the primary goal, is to provide information that we can use for any expansion of the program during the subsequent rate case. This is really important to adequately align the costs of this with the benefits in those three major rate areas, if you will. So that is it. I just want to emphasize, which I emphasized last week, at our utility meeting that we have. Well, first of all, we've enjoyed collaboration with aggregators, and in particular, I appreciate Brad being here and your participation in the Equifis pilot. And in fact, for the first time ever, you used open ADR standards to get to cold storage warehouses, and that was a terrific demonstration of how we could do that and using cold storage warehouses as a thermal mass and how you move that load up and down. We're pretty excited about that because we think with over 100 cold storage warehouses, the potential there is 40, 50 megawatts of potential load that is that could be ready to go if the incentives are correct and the value stream is correct. I also have emphasized to our utilities that we any interaction we've had with aggregators is that we've sent the message, please don't, and the emphasis is on don't, don't go to individual loads inside a utility service territory without checking in with the utility. That is actually one of our, when I say that, for our customer utilities, and it's along the model for energy efficiency in general that we really don't want any kind of third-party service provider to do that on behalf of BPA without checking in with the utility and getting their full buy-in for that. So we let me assure the utilities who are in the room that that's one of our operating principles that we've asked our any kind of aggregator that we come in contact, please don't do that without checking with utilities. Now, having said that, we've had great success in doing just that through our cold storage warehouse pilot, and we think we've been very successful at that so far. Absolutely, total partnership with utilities, total partnership, of course, with end loads. We don't ever want to get, from a BPA standpoint, don't ever want to get into interfering with the relationship that individual utilities have with their end loads, whether it's a residential customer or a large 60-megawatt plant in their service territory. So have I missed anything, Tom or Jason? They keep me honest.
Staff is comfortable. Any questions? We'll go back there first.
Yeah, hi. You talked about, early in your presentation, you talked about opportunities to combine energy efficiency and demand response. And I was just curious about that, and I have a question that's kind of a specific example. Maybe it'll illustrate it for me. So you talked about heat pump water heaters and that importance of that technology and supply curve or whatever. And that BPA is interested in pursuing energy efficiency as well as demand response opportunities through the heat pump water heaters. So I just, using that as an example, like a policy level, was there ever a tension between energy efficiency goals and demand response goals, given that if you're reducing energy efficiency, you're actually, well, you're reducing kW, but you're also reducing your potential dispatchable capacity?
Well, we recognize that. And what we'd like to think, instead of compromise, we'd like to think, how do you optimize for both? And so I think that Ken has a subject later today you're going to talk about.
You forget to it. Yeah. We have time,
so,
yeah.
So, from a BPA perspective, it's energy efficiency, and we want to make sure that we optimize energy efficiency. But are there ways to use a very energy-efficient new product for heat pump water heaters, for example, for also demand response opportunities? So we're interested in exploring those. So what I mentioned, it wasn't really part of this presentation, it was just kind of introductory remarks, was, you know, that's what I asked the EPRI Research Institute to really think about. How does one optimize? And I don't want to say that's the kind of the lead comment, but there's these opportunities where, and I, again, prefer not to think about tension or compromise, but rather how do you optimize both so that you get the benefits of the same end load for both. And it could be in building management, it could be heat pump water heaters, it could be in variable drives for pumps, large pumps, multi-megawatt pumps. We think there's a lot of possibilities there. I mentioned heat pump water heaters because it's something that is in the program, but now how do we get back into to exploring what is this DR potential, because we haven't done that yet.
Let me just add something to that. But part of what's come up and has actually been taken up in Pindrop too is the combining and the joint presentation of the possibilities for energy efficiency and DR by the same people to the customers has a lot of advantages. They don't hear from the utility 1 month about EE and then the next month about DR, and they're, well, what is this, you know? So that kind of consolidation is just about win-win. You get a good consistent message to the customer. There is the possibility of trade-offs between DR and EE, and that's just, I mean, we face trade-offs in all kinds of situations, and this is another one. Try to do that right is what optimization is.
One thing that comes up in commissions is trying to figure out how to focus on the right thing. Usually the right thing is the least long-term cost, and focusing on too hard on any one thing can get you off track. So that sometimes happens.
And let's just not forget that energy efficiency is the least cost resource, and the Pacific Northwest leads in that area. So how do we best – let me just say, in comparison to, say, TVA, who has a really advanced demand response program, and now they're just moving ahead with energy efficiency. So it's actually a little bit opposite. So different parts of the country have had different emphasis, in the last 10 or 15 years.
So, Lee, this is good stuff, as I expected. I have a question on the partnerships and collaborations you were talking about as you move into moving into commercial DR with some more steroids. I saw, for example, you talked about the possibility of partnerships outside of BPA, one of those BPA. I'm wondering if you were thinking about collaborations maybe between consumer-owned and investor-owned utilities, partnerships that would be, or is it all going to be consumer-owned utilities, or how does that fit in?
Well, we're interested in all the above. You know, what kind of partnerships? A one example could be, let's put it this way. It's easiest to work from just a policy, and when I say policy, it'd be easiest to construct a contract from my perspective with a load-following utility inside the balancing authority. In contrast, it'd probably be most challenging to do it with, even for our customer base, a slice utility who is their own balancing authority. Because then, how do you move how do you schedule and move that interchange of demand response across that balancing authority boundary? That's a challenge for us. That's a policy issue, but we think it's solvable. You know, we want to explore kind of all of the above. But our emphasis, at first at least, is to provide our consumer-owned utilities, whether slicers or load-following utilities, the first opportunity to participate in this. The first opportunity. I've never thought of it. Okay, what if somebody, an IOU and a consumer utility, combined and said, we want to do this?
For example, data centers that are across different parts of the Northwest, one would be an IOU, one would be a consumer utility service.
It has to be, again, we're working through the utilities, so it'd have to not only... It'd have to include those two utilities, absolutely.
Lee, I guess the point, and this happens in other parts of the country, is that people who see mutual interest will hopefully see that and gravitate toward the relationships that they need, whether they're traditional relationships or not.
And while I say the emphasis right now, or the priority probably is right now, to work with our consumer-owned utilities, our customer utilities, we don't want to just take completely off the table the opportunity to work with other IOUs and those who are not our preference customers, either now or in the future. But by the same token, we do want to be clear, there might be just a certain set of projects that we can – remember, there's several dimensions of this – not a large number of projects based on what we think we can manage, the dollar value that we have available for the next 2 years – And really trying to test, are we testing the right kinds of uses for demand response? I would I would project that we probably don't want to enter into multiple contracts for utilities to just use it for peak load management, because from a BPA standpoint, probably more valuable to have inks and decks and ancillary services to be part of that. But that's a challenge. Let me emphasize that there's multiple challenges. The first is the use of the same resource by utility and BPA, and that's both a policy and technical challenge. We're working on both. And the same use of the resource for more than one purpose, ancillary services, peak load management, and so on. And that's also a contractual and technical challenge. But we think we're at the right stage where this is a good opportunity to start that process.
Okay, did I see a question from over here? Yeah, this is great stuff, Lee. Segment agnostic, commercial, industrial, residential?
Yes, although let me just say that we see probably more opportunity immediately in the commercial industrial space. And you can tell that by our engagement with the City of Port Angeles with a large industrial load. One point that you need to make the connection for a large industrial load, not without its own complexity. We need to work through that, but we understand the complexity of large residential programs, although we're interested in that too, especially if they're already well established. Conrad had a question?
No.
I got the mic, though.
I'm curious about some of these other projects, the heat pump water heaters in particular, and municipal wastewater treatment. Can you say a word about that, or is that available on the BPA website?
We have a heat pump water heater project that's mostly around the energy efficiency targets. We actually had to drop the combined use. We weren't moving forward with the heat pump water heater project. So I wish I could tell you more, but we want to continue to look for those opportunities. I mentioned that and kind of emphasized that because we're looking for the opportunity. Where's the confluence of energy efficiency and demand response in heat pump water heater? So I can almost guarantee that's going to be in our request for solicited proposals in the next rounds of R&D projects. Now, the wastewater treatment project, and I don't know if anybody from eWeb is here or is on the phone, because I got to give them a lot of credit. This is a large energy efficiency project to improve the energy efficiency of their large municipal pumps. And for an incremental cost, not much, you add a DR component, and now you can use those municipal pumps for. So they're improving a huge improvement, hundreds of thousands of dollars in improvement, and with incredible payback for energy efficiency, incremental cost to use it for demand response. And it's, again, a great partnership, cost-share partnership. We're moving forward with that. And that's just one example.
Just a really quick question, Lee. The $3.2 million was fiscal 13 and 14. Did I read that
it's
right?
Fiscal 14 and 15.
Okay. So yep. 14 comes up October 1st.
Yep. So our plan is to have and we're going to push pretty hard in the next 6 months or so to get that October 1st where we have a portfolio of projects. We either have or will soon, you know, at that point, sign the contracts for that. It's just a contractual issue that we want to make sure the contracts are in place. And that's, again, a little bit of new territory for us at BPA with this ancillary service using a demand response component. So really, October 1st is a starting line to actually execute that. Next 6 months would be arranging the role of aggregators, which utilities, what is the portfolio of projects, and then nominally launch on October 1st for the next two or three years. Excuse me.
Okay, Lee, I think that is great, and I think we're going to move to our last agenda block for the day, a series of short topics that Ken has organized from the buzz of things going on in the world around here. And the first one is going to be the oversupply technical oversight committee, and then we'll hopefully get to all of these. Ken has graciously put himself last.
That's so, right. We run out of time.
So everyone needs to be efficient so that we can hear Ken's last reports as a council employee with PMDOT.
Oh, yeah.
So we have some slides for Paul.
Well, just one. I'm Paul Marmon, and I'll be brief here. About 8 months ago, I began an effort to inadequately fill Ken Dragoon's shoes as facilitator of something called the OTOC, the Oversupply Technical Oversight Committee. And this OTOC was formed to search for solutions to the so-called oversupply problem. And I'm really here to make a request to a lot of you on behalf of this OTOC group, which I'll get to at the end of my remarks. A lot of you, there's probably a range of understanding about what oversupply is, and it's hard to describe without getting in trouble. But just briefly, it is oversupply is a term describing a situation that occurs mainly in the springtime in the Northwest in light load hours, and it's so far mainly a problem that Bonneville's experienced, in which there is so much generation, so much carbon-free must-run generation that it exceeds load. And Bonneville's in a situation where even if it offers to give away power, it can't dispose of all its must-run generation. So it's faced with a situation where it has to ask, and it's typically come down to wind generation to feather its blades and reduce generation, which the wind generators are willing to do, but it costs them something to do that. So they say, we're willing to do it. We want to be paid. Bonneville says, we're not willing to pay you we'll give you free power, but we won't pay you, and hence the conundrum. And I think, as someone said, or Brian said earlier, in some sense, it really is an economic issue, because physically you can feather you can turn off wind generation, but the issue is the cost to do that, and Bonneville has been unwilling to do it. So far, this issue, I think it's safe to say that the actual cost of oversupply has been exceeded by the staff costs of legal battles before FERC and studies and et cetera and et cetera. So it's, the one thing I did want to use this for. Just one piece of this I wanted to draw your attention to. Bonneville just came out with this retrospective on last year's oversupply. It's a really good piece of work. If you're interested in this, it's great. But this this little dot down here shows the amount of, quote, oversupply. That is the amount by which BPA displaced wind generation last year, and BPA uniquely uses this term called megawatt months, which is a megawatt month is 730 megawatt hours. And so last year there was 50,000 megawatt hours of displacement due to this oversupply, wind displacement due to this oversupply problem. The year before that was about 100,000 megawatt hours. The cost of it last year was about $3 million. So, you know, in the scheme of things, in terms of actual experience, it hasn't been that big a deal so far. And, in fact, I think that's leading some people to say, well, you know, maybe this is a tempest in the teapot. Maybe it's really not that big a problem. I think what this curve says to me, anyway, is that this is Bonneville's curve. It basically says if you go over here to about the 25% exceedance probability, the amount of wind displacement would have been 10 times as much as it actually was last year. And if you go, you know, to the 5% exceedance probability, it gets to be a really big number. So Bonneville's analysis suggests that, yeah, so far we haven't had to displace much wind. Arguably, Bonneville's been lucky, and the risk of a very significant amount of wind displacement is not trivial. And it's like the risk of running a stop sign. You know, about 75% of the time you don't hit anybody, but 25% of the time you do. So significant risk. This OTOC group was chartered by something called the Wind Integration Steering Committee, again, to look at solutions for this, ways to mitigate this issue. It looked at dozens of potential solutions, and primary conclusion is there is no single bullet. There is no single solution that will really eliminate this problem. On the other hand, there are a lot of solutions that are already being implemented. There are a lot of others that are very actively in play being looked at. Two of them I just want to talk about briefly here, two of those potential solutions. One is something we call load shifting, which is kind of a kissing cousin to demand response. It's the concept that a number of utilities in the region have retail rate structures that arguably levy too high, rates are too high, particularly on the demand side in light load hours. And the thought here is that if utilities simply restructure the retail rates such that they more accurately reflected the relative cost of service and light load hours relative to heavy load hours, you might induce some loads to shift out of heavy load hours into light load hours, which would mitigate oversupply, because oversupply is smaller by the amount you boost light load hour loads in the springtime. So maybe this is something that, without some external subsidy from Bonneville, could actually help to mitigate the problem. So that particular idea was kicked to the Pacific Northwest Utilities Conference Committee, which is facilitating a group of currently about 10 utilities who express interest in exploring this concept of load shifting, a kind of in a loose collaborative means. And that effort is getting underway. And if you're not participating and are interested, let me know, because I'm facilitating that too. The second thing, and the source of the request I want to make, is demand response. So the Lee and his staff came to the OTOC and described what they thought the potential might be for demand response programs, which were of a type that could mitigate oversupply, because some can't. To mitigate oversupply, you really need to shift load for multi-hours into light load hours, not just for seconds or minutes. But there are some that can do that. So they described a potential that might be in the 300 to 400 megawatt range over the midterm, at costs of $2 to $6 a kilowatt a month. The advantage of that is they were seen by this OTOC was that the technical demands are pretty low for a demand response program that can mitigate oversupply, and that the warning you have of a need for that load shift is probably hours and sometimes days ahead. We're not talking about seconds ahead, and the needs for telemetry and automation are very low. It can be done with a phone call. So that's the upside. The downside is that even according to Bonneville's estimates, the cost of oversupply on an expected value basis are not that high. Their estimate is about $12 million a year, and it would take about 1,500 megawatts of load shift to largely offset that problem. So you do the math, and that turns out to about a buck a kilowatt month worth of value. And you can't pay for a lot of demand response with a buck a kilowatt month. Other problems are the issue is intermittent. A lot of years will go by, and you would never have to pull the trigger on demand response to mitigate oversupply. Other years, you'd have to do it a lot. Another issue is it's hard to monetize this value, because Bonneville is not currently offering to pay for oversupply mitigation, so it's hard to turn that into money. So despite all that, the conclusion of the OTOC was that although oversupply won't by itself economically justify demand response programs, the thought is that it can be a contributor to the economics of an over-demand response program, and the and for that reason, it ought to be on the table. So the request that the OTOC came up with, and I make it to those of you who are either implementing, considering implementing demand response programs, is to factor in the oversupply considerations as you design, both in the design of demand response programs. Think about oversupply as one of the purposes, and in the economics. That last point, it's easy for me to say, please consider the economics. I'm not quite sure how you do that because it's hard to get paid for doing this. So I think that's a solution that needs to be worked on. But that's the request, and you'll save a lot of billable hours by attorneys if you do it. So,
okay.
That's it.
All right. Thank you. We have a question.
I think this is a quick one. I think I, in my mind, tended to lump oversupply and Bonneville saying that it's running out of capacity to do reserves into the, basically into the same thing. And I'm getting the idea, based on what you're saying, that maybe I shouldn't be doing that, that oversupply,
yeah,
as you said, is really an economic issue.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Eric, because I meant to say that we talk in the region about the challenges of wind integration, and we tend to, when we talk about wind integration challenges, we tend to talk about, I think, in two categories, balancing, which is most of what was discussed here today. How do you balance the short-term fluctuations in wind generation and oversupply? And between those two, the balancing challenge is by far the biggest challenge. It's, in terms of technical complexity and size of issue and economics, it's really the big issue. The oversupply issue as a wind integration challenge is smaller and frankly more tractable, but they're not the same, and I think really the balancing issue is by far the bigger issue,
and that is a reliability issue as opposed to an economic issue.
Bonneville might argue a little bit with calling oversupply strictly an economic issue, but I think it's predominantly an economic issue. Where balancing is, well, in part a reliability issue. Oversupply, I don't think of as a reliability issue in the main.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We are more aware.
Okay. Do I have somebody from the city of Port Angeles on the phone?
Bob Capus here.
Bob, I'm glad you said so, because I'd forgotten your name. I knew that Phil wasn't going to talk, but you were. I don't know whether you can you see your presentation on the screen here?
Yes, sir. I can see the slide deck.
Okay. Well, hello. Let me get it back like it should be. There.
Thank you.
I'll change slides for you if you want to take us through it. We can give you about 10 minutes.
Okay. So I got a bit of an echo there.
We can hear that. It's not objectionable here.
Okay, good. This is a presentation that was put together by Phil. It's a little bit longer than I think what the time is in front of us, so it's going to be a little bit of a demonstration in load shedding here as I go through it.
All right, we'll appreciate that.
I'm a commercial energy analyst here at the City of Port Angeles. Phil Lusk is our Deputy Director of Power and Telecommunication Systems, and Joey Curry is our residential energy analyst. The three of us have been actively involved in our demand response projects here at the City of Port Angeles. If I could have the next slide, please. Just give you a little bit of background about who we are and where we are. We are that little A just below that balloon right there, is about offset to the left side of mid-screen. We're on the north side of the Olympic Peninsula, and we are at the end of a transmission line, of a BPA transmission line. So energy efficiency and power management here for us is very important, not only to the City of Port Angeles, but to BPA and the region. Next slide, please.
Go ahead.
City is one of the oldest electric utilities on the West Coast. Actually, started producing or generating electricity here about 122 years ago this month. If we can skip through the next couple of slides there to slide number 5. There we go. Up.
Is that 5?
Well, slide number 6 will work just fine.
Okay.
The city has a history in demand response projects here. We're beginning in 2005 with the GridWise testbed demonstration project and continuing today with the commercial industrial DR project, which we are continuing along the T&I grant with BPA to investigate turning some of this into an actual market demonstration of demand response. We have a history of experience in residential demand and in wind integration pilots as well. Next slide, please. Two key drivers that have our interest in DR are, one, the challenges of being able to effectively implement and manage the tiered rate methodology that BPA has implemented in 2001, particularly with focus on management of peak demand and critical peak periods through load shaping, if we can do that. And the second driver is that our infrastructure, like most infrastructures for utilities, is aging. Our electric meters and water meters are towards the end of their serviceable life, and we are in the process of replacing those. Next slide, please. So under the direction of the City Council, the utility opted to deploy advanced metering infrastructure. We are looking to deploy a little over 10,000 electric meters and about 8,400 water meters, all tied into the AMI. We opted for a turnkey solution, and we are currently involved in implementation of that. We hope to be fully deployed by the end of 2013. Along with that, we've received direction from our council to ramp up our conservation programs to be able to avoid Tier 2 power requirements. The AMI system helps actually to reinforce some of our conservation messages that we're giving to our customers through our rates that we are working on implementing. And actually, the information of time of use data to come back to our customers will help them, or at least assist them in their conservation efforts and showing them when and what time of day they are using the most energy. We are also implementing a voluntary DR project for all of our customers, including residential, commercial, and industrial. Next. Thank you. We've actually have developed a new electric rate design. It involves seasonal rates as well as three rates throughout the course of the day. For our residential customers, there are no demand side rates associated with it. However, we have provided demand response credits within the rate structure for our customers. We also are implementing a time of use rate for general service demand in primary customers, which actually has a demand charge associated with the peak period only. Next, please. This is pretty much a rehash of what we have there, except for we are actually going through cost of service analysis, and we're looking at implementing or continuing with the time of use rates for future rate structures in 2014. And some of those drivers associated with that is going to be new information that we're receiving from BPA about expected increases in transmission charges for the city of Port Angeles. So we are currently working on implementing a residential demand pilot, installing water heater controllers and smart thermostats. At present, we have about 41 customers that are fully implemented with the thermostats and the water heater controllers. We also have a wind integration pilot project that's in place. We have some water heater controllers and Steffes room heaters as part of that thermal storage project It's been undergoing for about 18 months now. We're still collecting some information over this winter, and we'll continue to August, I believe. As well, we've had a commercial and industrial pilot project with 8 customers. We range from 5 kilowatts up to 15 megawatts, actually. We've had a successful pilot underneath there in controlling those loads and working with BPA. And actually, all of our customers underneath that program have indicated to us that they would gladly continue in the DR program with us. We are also working actively on implementing a voltage optimization program here at the utility. We have just about all the components in place. What's missing for us is the end-of-line data feedback and automation of the system. However, we should be able to have that system up and operating, we hope, by the end of this year. Next slide, please. So this graph actually kind of helps to drive home the point of why we're looking at demand response and energy efficiency and conservation. This is a graph of a worst-case scenario for one of our residential customers, in which we've not been able to get the demand charge over associated with that rate. However, you can see that if you look at the right-ins up towards the middle of the graph, that the effects of this customer on the utility peak actually cost us more than what we are collecting from the customer over the course of the period. Again, this is the worst-case scenario. This would be on the coldest day in the wintertime, and it would be a time when everything would be coming on in the morning, the water heaters, the lights, the furnace, all that activity coming on inside the house, all opportunities for us to implement demand response on a large part of that equipment. Next slide, please. So through the programs that we've operated, we've learned that customers participate largely based upon what their perception of the value is. A lot of them have participated because they thought it would be of overall value to the utility. However, incentives that were put on the table help to maintain the customer's participation within those programs. C&I projects have made it very clear to us that it's very important to come to an understanding of what the baseline is so we understand exactly how much load is being shed during a demand response, so the customer has an understanding of it as well as us, because ultimately that's going to be the bottom line for the cash register to figure out any sort of credits available for demand response. And then at this point, it's kind of uncertain what the actual value of DR is to the utility and to its customers. We really don't know what the overall effect of shifting load and balancing load may have for us. We're still trying to work out some of those finer points of the program. And to add more complexity to the situation, we've just received word about 2 months ago that there will be some increased transmission rate charges for us in fiscal 2014. And we're trying to figure out how we can use DR as well to mitigate some of those charges. Next slide, please. So our next direction, our next steps on this project is going to be developing what an actual DR market would look like here at the utility, what the market value of the sheds are to our customers, to the city, and to BPA. This program is currently underneath the development with BPA, and we plan to leverage what we already have deployed. We may deploy a few more pieces of equipment at a couple of different loads, but for the most part, we're going to use what's already existing in place. Next slide, please. This is a slide which kind of shows the partnerships that's come together around this next demonstration project. As you can see, there's quite a bit of cross-sector team coming from BPA's end to assist us. We actually have a number of customers from the CNI pilot project that are going to participate in this project as well. And we also have the capability, as Lee pointed out earlier, of the continued support of the Ulstrom grid for this project going forward. Next slide, please. So basically what we want to do is have the utility operate as a demand response aggregator so that we would put together all the assets that we have into a response for a load shed coming from BPA and to be able to meet their needs through a multitude of assets that we have and be able to deploy them based upon their availability. We've been able to operate the market for inks and decks. That would be loads, sheds, and load increases. And we would, primarily for the city's needs, we'd like to do that to shift our peak demand around. But also be able to provide some balancing reserves for the region. And underneath this program, we're trying to figure out what are the true market values for inks and decks, so that we can continue support of our program by our customers. Next slide. And slide pretty much speaks for itself. I mean, we'll be looking at an expansion of FastDR, which will hopefully help for ancillary services. We're looking at some quick load response here for load following capabilities, as well as perhaps system protection, being as we are at the end of a transmission line here. Next slide. This is a picture of one of the locations where we have a lithium battery storage system deployed. And if we show the next slide, we'll give you a picture of the actual system. It's a 45-kilowatt battery storage system that is directly connected to the landing mall's electric load. It has a fast-acting inverter, which is capable in total of 70 kilowatts for about a half-hour deployment, or we could deploy about 40 kilowatts for an hour and a half. This is actually a very fast-acting resource. We've actually tripped it off in less than 10-minute notice for a load ink. Next slide, please. This is a photo of the of one of the pop lines over at Nippon Paper Industries. This is the large industrial load that we've been talking about. This is one of these lines alone is about 18 megawatts of total power associated with it. Those are 12,000 horsepower motors. Next slide. So one of the key components key aspects of deploying this this asset is what condition the pulp line is in, what operating condition it's in. If it's actually just idling, if it just came offline, if they were just to shut it down and the motor was still spinning, we'd have the capability of deploying the asset within 10 minutes. However, if it was actually all the way closed down, it would take a full half hour to get the load back up and running. This is a 12,000 horsepower motor. They cannot just cold start the motor. They have to get the motor up and running with a hydraulic starter until it comes up to synchronous speed, and then they can turn on the motor itself. Next slide. So this is a graph which represents an actual deployment of the pulping line at Nippon. The reason for the deployment was for a deck, a load increase. It was a quick response to come through to our customers. We actually missed it by about 5 minutes to get the load up to full power. However, the graph is a pretty good demonstration that it does work. The technology is there. And they were able to respond within pretty good time frame. Again, this is an operator to operator time level here. So this is a phone call that would be coming, or a internet message that would be coming from the BPA dispatcher to the operator at the pulp line at the mill, who would have to then take that message over to his supervisor, sort of assess what their needs are, what their storage capability is, what their production needs are, and see if they can actually start up the line or shed the line. So it's a pretty good demonstration of the technology, that the capability of the plant to react. Next plant, or next slide, please. Okay, so far we've secured commitments from our participants in the CNI demonstration project, including a large industrial customer that would be the Nippon plant. We've started discussions with our customers on agreements, and we've actually been working with BPA and our customers to help identify the key issues of concern to everybody, see that we can come up with some sort of agreements on how to protect them contractually. We also are trying to identify the event parameters, such as time, duration, and coming around to some sort of agreements of what we're going to do to mitigate risk and the actual payment structures that we'll provide to our customers. Next slide, please. So expected benefits for the region are, of course, more reliability for the grid, distribution network, help to reduce volatile costs for the utility and demand and transmission. It's going to help keep utility costs stable for our customers, and it's going to delay hardwire solutions and upgrades to the distribution system and transmission system throughout the region. Next slide, please. So additional benefits is going to be key here for this project is it also has the capability of doing some large decks, which is wind integration or integration of renewable energy to help balance the load throughout the region, which is something that has been identified by BPA as a key issue for the region going forward. Next slide, please. As well, we hope to be able to provide a scalable product to apply across the region for BPA, develop a business structure with applicability for future customer relationships, and also have some tools in place for ancillary services markets. Next slide. So at this point, we're working on what our contract model is going to look like between the city and BPA. And it's going to be based upon who is actually going to initiate the event. Is it going to come to the city and we're going to take it to the customer, or is it going to go directly operator to operator? What's the criteria for to initiate events? Size, time, all of the hard parameters of what we'd be looking at for an event itself. And then one of the final questions out here is can a partial response of some sort help alleviate the problems with BPA in the region and qualify for a DR event? Next slide, please. So we're actually working out some of the contract and issues with our customers. part of the list of those discussions include payment structure. How are we going to forward some incentives to our customers? Currently, we're looking at being able to do a capacity payment, perhaps with some reserve for performance. Trying to work out other issues of how do non-performance events affect the capacity payments or the incentives that are available to the customers as well. And that brings us to the end of the presentation.
Okay. Bob, we've got another presenter here, and we want to get them in before people have to leave for planes. So, Bob's contact information, as I remember, is on this. It'll be posted. If you have questions for Bob, you can contact him directly. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thank you.
So the issue of water heaters as demand response has been a regular topic at Pindrop, and Conrad Eustace is here with a report about that.
This is it.
Yep. So my name is Conrad Eustace, and I'm the Director of Retail Technology Strategy at Portland General Electric. And I have a long history in DR. Basically, starting in 93, I did a number of projects. In 95, I did probably the first energy service where people paid for a demand response type solution. And quickly abandoned because, likely, I discovered that, you know, you got to have standards at the appliance before you can ever make demand response really cost effective. And then I got distracted testing AMI technologies and eventually wrote our business case for our $150 million AMI project and got it approved. And judging by the awards, it's probably been the most successful AMI implementation in the country. But since writing that business case, I've been working full-time on demand response. And for the last 7 years, I now have a solution to make demand response exceptionally cost-effective. And you're going to hear about it today for the first time with a model that will work for the Northwest. And I want to thank Jeff Hamerlin here because a lot of my storage and a lot of the sort of DR 2.0 sort of features of this came because I helped out instructing his class and focused on sustainability. So there's a lot of those elements in this.
3 years and lives to tell about it.
Yeah. So this originally started as a short take with what ANSI / CEA 2045, and so there's a long history to how this came to be, but the bottom line is it's a, it got passed and approved by the Consumer Electronics Association last December 26th, and there's been a whole lot of people, including PNNL, that have helped get it to where it's at. And what it is essentially like a USB port for appliances. And there's two flavors of it. One has an AC outlet and one has a DC outlet, USB strictly DC. The AC has the advantage that what's going to happen is you're going to plug in a communication module, and that can be power line carrier. So the power comes right from wherever the appliance plugs in into the communication module, transferred to PLC, and then comes back through the serial side of that socket to instruct the appliance. And so even technologies like Hunt and TWAX and so forth can be used. EPRI has tested something. Let's see if it's on the next slide. So this is the A.O. Smith water heater that's been out in the market now for 2 years. I have one in my house. And several employees that I've put in my house, their houses. And the socket that you see in the lower left is an early version of the CEA standard. And it's like sort of the serial port on your PC back in 1986. And it uses a very basic serial communication, but it powers whatever plugs in. And this is available today, but it's not quite the CEA standard. And I'll get to the opportunity with A.O. Smith in a second. So we actually have a pilot going with this. This is sort of the architecture, but the key point here is you can plug any communication technology into this port. So Converge and Cooper, Canon, are actually very much participants in this, and they were actually making some of their modules to plug in. But the beauty of this is the consumer can plug it in. Instead of having to schedule an install, instead of having to have all those power relays in the box, you're using the appliance's controls. And in volume, this is going to be less than $15 per device, which is the heart to making it very cheap. So, and why should you care about this? Is because in a nutshell, it reduces the cost of DR by at least a factor of 10. And I give this example that the incremental cost of the water heater is $10 to $20. And there's a quote that we have from A.O. Smith themselves. And the communication devices in volume, like the millions of water heaters in the Northwest, would be $15. And the coincident factor is very roughly allowing from some disallowance of, you know, people not using it. It's like about 0.6 kW. And if it were a heat pump water heater, probably about 0.3, just a simple estimate. And so even with a heat pump water heater, you're talking about $115 per kW, which compared to a power plant is dirt cheap. And so in terms of a business model, this gives plenty of benefits for everybody to share. And actually, the biggest dollar is going to flow back to the consumer. So to quote Amy Lovins, this is a, you know, a lunch that you get paid to eat. And it's going to be very cheap. So we have 3.4 million water heaters in the Northwest. One of the key things you have to observe about this is it's not a retrofit technology. So you've got to wait for these things to change out. And I'm going to show you a spreadsheet in a second that shows the evolution of these being changed out. But ultimately, you're reaching a 2,000 megawatts, so, you know, a couple nuclear plants, worth of peak load mitigation for less than $100 per kW if I weight in the resistance water heaters. But wait, there's more. All this talk today about all those things you want for wind and balancing and regulation, this can do it all. But first I digress into Water Heater 101. And so in the graduate they said, you know, water heaters, that's the future. And so water heaters have two heating elements, and the lower heating element comes on first if you start with cold water, but the upper element has priority. And the beauty of this system is that you can always control with a smart water heater the upper element to be on, which means the customer always has hot water. They run out if they take a big bath or something, but that's more than enough for a shower. But what that means is by keeping the lower part of the tank cold, you have unmet demand to heat the water. And when you start to multiply that 6.4 kWh by a lot of water heaters, it turns out you've got thousands of megawatt hours every day that you can shape by simply turning on the water heater at will all day long to recharge that cold water. And that's the heart of both an ink and deck approach that I'll show you in a second. So this is an example of a load following or an ink or deck approach, which is essentially, I won't go into the details because we're short on time, but you divide all the water heaters into 60 groups, one for every minute of the hour, and you're giving each water heater a command at the beginning of their appropriate minute for how many minutes they're going to be on during that hour. And it'll be nominally somewhere around, you want to get maybe around 300 watts, so that'll only be on average for the hour. So it'll be like 3 minutes on, about, maybe. And then, however, during its on time, you can extend it or cut it back to give you real-time control, and you'll have several groups on at once, so collectively you can, the water heaters are coming on at 400 to 500 watts, but their average power is 300 watts. So anyway, I can go into a lot more details, but basically this gives you in a fully mature Northwest system, a 2,000 megawatt spinning receiver all day long, every hour of the day. It's sitting at 1,000 as the average sort of charge rate, and then you can take it down to zero, or you can take it up to 2,000, and you can take it up a lot, actually, much higher. You can take it up much more than you can take it down. But you can also shape it. So on a day where the wind comes in early, you can just charge up the water heater sooner. Or if it comes in later, you can cut back that $1,000 while you wait for the wind to show up. So it's a completely symmetric Enkin deck. And the control room dial literally would have the operators being able to crank up megawatts and down every minute. They could put in a new request and get it within a range of whatever the installed base is. And you get all this by just plugging in that little communication device. There's a couple more steps we've got to do. Here's an example of just shifting energy to the off-peak. If you knew it was going to be a day in the spring where you had all this excess energy, you would really minimize the flow, you know, recharge during the day. And in a fully mature system, you'd have 21,000 megawatt hours that you could recharge at night. So there's some benefit there. And the heart of it, I'm not going to go into this, but there's those on the left is how the water heater operates today. The black lines are the water heater draws, and the water heater instantly comes on, and that's what produces the little load shape that we're all familiar with. But what's happening here when you keep the cold water at the bottom is that you can determine when you recharge it. And so those pink lines on the right side are just an arbitrary shape where this was for a summer peak, so I'm allowing it to charge sort of midday, and then in the afternoon I take it to zero, and then at night I'm doing more, just valley filled. So I'm doing some hedging just for standard power costs. So the reason I'm bringing it up now is because there's one big assumption about how this model works I should mention first, which is in order to make this work, you've got to get the water heaters to arrive in the region with the socket on it. And right now, Whirlpool, A.O. Smith, brands Whirlpool, is putting it on the 9-year and 12-year warranty water heaters, but not the 6-year warranty. And the 6-year warranty is where they sell 90% of their product. So this is where the $10 to $15 comes. And I'm going to show you a spreadsheet where if we were to, as a region, come together as a group and pay that, we would earn huge dividends on that, as I'll show you in a second. But there's a lot of models out there right now competing with an open interface on the water heater. So far, A.O. Smith has been supported. Rheem has been involved in the development as well, and they make, between the two, about 80% of the water heaters. So, for instance, Whirlpool and GE through AHAM are very much keeping a proprietary lock on their connected appliances. And that proprietary lock means the customer or us is going to have to pay whatever price they charge to unlock it. And Whirlpool is going to have you unlock it at their website, and GE says you've got to have their little nucleus or some sort of gateway. But we're not in charge anymore. And if since Whirlpool has some influence over A.O. Smith, and since they sell a bunch of their water heaters, I mean, they're going to be under pressure to go their proprietary way. So we have we have this lost opportunity, and the lost opportunity is to come together and start paying A.O. Smith. They're very open to a regional solution like this, where we come in and we get every water heater in the Northwest to come with a socket. And it may sound like a lot of dollars, but you'll see in a second it pays back handsomely. And you get basically a $130 million present value with only 28% adoption. And I think in a system where you never run out of hot water and you get paid $50 a month, I think you'd find a much higher participation than 30%. So the next slide is a lot of numbers. And so I'm not going to go through these things. But over here on the right, there's this $132 million. Just to show you in a spreadsheet, there is a way to get to that number. But what's happening here, just really quickly, we got years here. We got the number of water heaters being sold in the Northwest based on sort of like a 16-year life for water heaters. So now there's the cumulative water heaters that have been sold. This is the percent of water heater heat pumps putting in place, and I just sort of made up the schedule. I'd have to get with other people to know the exact thing. But the point here that I want to make is I'm giving the exact same incentives for DR to both resistance and heat pump water heaters, even though, yes, heat pump water heaters give a lot less benefit. And that's so that we don't interfere with the idea that we want to incent heat pump water heaters through the energy efficiency credits to happen. Same DR incentives, but remember, I already showed you it's $115 a kW even for a heat pump water heater. So we're not losing anything by giving the same benefits. And over on the right, there's some numbers that are dealing with the actual percentages based on this heat pump. Then you've got the in the early years, when there's just A.O. Smith that's producing the water heaters, I've got to get some major rebates out there so customers buy A.O. Smith over Rheem. And Rheem won't be very much far behind if we do that, because it'll shift market share and they won't like that. Plus, they've already done most of the work to get there, so they'll be happy to get there. Once they start selling, we can start cutting back on the rebates at the time of sale. And all we're trying to do is cover the incremental costs, and I've got the $20 down per water heater. Every water heater sold in the Northwest. So the hard part is how, as people in the Northwest, we come up with that money. Then I have an adoption rate. It starts at 2% and eventually ends up at 30, and then it's the number of customers on it. I have an incentive to let customers sign up in this column. Then there's the communication device initially in low volume is more costly, but eventually reaches $15. When you've got millions of things, you can make communication electronics very cheap. Then here's the annual customer incentive of initially $50 a year for a lot. So then here's, in this column, is the sunk cost of those $20 on all water heaters. So this is in millions of dollars. So very quickly, this is $3 million, $6 million, $6 million, $7 million. Once we're past the having to rebate, it comes down. You say, how are you ever going to pay that back? Well, you start looking at the carrying costs, and you get this column. So at a 12% carrying cost, which, you know, you can plug in whatever number you want, this is the cumulative carrying cost of all these capital costs. Then you've got the program cost, which includes, you know, the communication module, all the incentives for the customer, and their annual incentive. And those get to be pretty big. Out here, where you've got a lot of customers, you're up to $24 million. And the thing, the point here is most of those dollars are that $50 or $40 rebate to customers. So most of this money is not going to GE for their big combustion turbines. It's going back to the customers to stay on the program. So then over here, I've got megawatts and megawatt hours based on the, essentially that 6 kWh at the bottom and the 150 per kilowatt year, which is sort of the amortized revenue requirement for a peaking plant. And then I use those two numbers to show the value of benefits I'm getting. And if you can't read it, these are getting into tens of millions of dollars. And the net benefit reaching, it goes positive in like year, here's the net. In like year six, it's finally positive, where the net benefit against the carrying cost is positive. But by year 15, it's $60 million positive to the region. And the net present is 130. And this is with 30%. Like I said, you can take this down to 15% if you're worried about the risk of, you know, spending that money up front. The key, we've got to start getting A.O. Smith to put the water heaters in our region. And then that leads to the next slide, the last slide, which is sort of a timeline of a milestone. So, Lee, I'll come to you. And one of the projects to develop here for next year is a control program that can do some of the things. We can just start with basic load control. All we really need to do is turn it on and off and prove the connectivity. We'd also want to research how to best control heat pump water heaters so that we're not messing those guys up. I'm not sure you can cycle them quite as much as you can cycle resistance. We need to develop programs to get the customer incentives so people will adopt. We have to make an offer to A.O. Smith after we figure out how we're going to pay for it. But, I mean, Portland General Electric for sure would more than pay our fair share. And you could have sort of this model where if everybody puts in, well, you could have a where you take the early adopter, like a BPA or a PGE, that are willing to put in their fair share for the region because they see the long-term value. And then you could have these water heaters have a lock code. And the other utilities could get their value by simply unlocking it with whatever the cost that was paid plus interest, if you will. But that sunk cost that I talk about, that's really trivial compared to the value. That carrying cost of the capital is like 15% of the whole program. So this is what standards does, Lee. It drives the cost down, and it's real today. But we have to come together, and it's a huge resource. Anyhow, I've got lots of economic and technical details. I could go on for hours on all of them at any level. I challenge anybody to tear it apart.
Ken, I'm going to give you the chance to run the time here, so you have a better sensitivity about how long
okay.
we can go.
It's after four, and I know some people have left because they have to catch a plane. Anybody else that needs to leave, we understand absolutely. We have a commitment to our sound guy to not be too much longer, so we're not going to go till five. But we can go a little bit longer here and do these questions.
Okay. Well,
so
I had a question on the phone.
All right.
Yeah.
So and this is the sort of thing that Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance in the energy efficiency area is designed for, to help with this sort of very sort of thing. And there's been concern and maybe even resistance on the part of utilities, including Portland General, about a role for NEA in moving beyond energy efficiency and into smart grid sorts of demand response spaces. But it seems like this might be a reasonable thing for an organization that already exists to work with, you know, appliance manufacturers and so on to lead.
I don't think we have a problem with NEA leading that charge. Market transformation, because they are good at it.
Yeah.
The real is an institution will get the dollars to A.O. Smith,
right.
And they're willing to do this. So a NEA, to the extent they can, so that would be great. There was another point that I wanted to make, but I've forgotten it.
And by the way, you spoke about this in my class last week, so this really isn't the first time you presented it.
Okay.
But, okay, right. Almost.
Okay. I didn't have the business model done.
You didn't have the business model. Okay.
So I'm not going to necessarily question your economics and what have you, but the question I have, and I've sort of been following this a little bit, so I'm not too sure where it all stands, but my understanding is that, you know, there are new standards going in for heat pumps, not for heat pumps, for water heaters. And if those new standards go in, then the only thing that's available are heat pump water heaters.
No. The new standard makes electric water heaters bigger than 55. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, it is exactly 55 and larger has to be 2.02.
Yeah.
It's some fractional.
But that's 55 and larger, which is 13% of the market at the moment. So most
water heaters are still small.
Most water heaters can be. There may be a movement into heat pumps. I won't deny that. But
this is your basic 50-gallon water heater, and that doesn't change.
So but then I guess my question is then how do you square that up with the utilities and particularly, quote-unquote, in Washington utilities under I-937 with the requirements to gain all cost-effective conservation and having to put in heat pump water heaters. Now, I know you have some heat pump water heaters in here.
A lot. I've got the market penetration. Maybe I don't have the exact penetration, but it won't. You tell me what the penetration will be for adoption. I'll stick it in this column. I'm not going to interfere with that. However the region can be pushed into going to heat pump water heaters, it won't affect the economics of this. So it does reduce the total megawatts and then reduce the total energy, but it doesn't reduce the economics. But, I mean, and that's why I'm saying I would offer the same incentives to come onto the program for both, just so that they're not swayed by that one.
It doesn't reduce the economics because you're already assuming heat pump water heaters in your economic assumption.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I don't dispute that even if you did it on heat pump water heaters, you would get some value out of that. The question is the value going to be less than what you assume of that mix changing? Then also I think there's going to be a lot more incentive. This is where what was raised earlier, is the issue of, okay, so you have energy efficiency and you have demand response. Mm-hmm. And at what level are we reducing the value of the energy efficiency? Because if you're saving 50%,
if you're saving approximately 50% of your hot water load with the heat pump water heater, are we basically now getting, is by doing this, are we getting it to maybe 40% or 30%? I don't know the answer.
It doesn't change the savings. In fact, as a percent, if you look at, let's just make it up. Let's say the electric water heater cost per year is $400 and the heat pump water heater is $200 for the same household load, and I add a $50 rebate to each of them, I make it $150 versus $350. It's a much better deal to go with the heat pump.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. I was talking about the kilowatt-hour savings.
The kilowatt-hour savings is already computed in these numbers. You tell me whatever schedule the heat pumps are going to be adopted, and I'm computing separate energy benefits for heat pump water heaters.
This is going to be a longer discussion, let's get a couple more questions, I guess.
I think one of the issues here is that the definition of all cost-effective energy efficiency is not absolute, and it depends on the regulator to help you decide what that is.
Yeah.
So that's a national phenomenon that I'll just leave it there.
Is it that I'm interfering with the adoption? Is that what you're saying?
Let's hear the other question.
Okay, yeah, okay.
You and your team know each other. You can talk, and I'd like to hear.
I'd like to hear.
I know we've got limited time. Yeah.
So I have a political question, and not to sound like a socialist or communist. Why do we have to ask what are the political issues with us having to ask the manufacturers to unlock this? Why is it not? I mean, have we... No.
That's a business model. They're not contemplating that. I'm contemplating that.
Okay.
The issue is, let's say BPA finds value, but not all of their customers are ready to step up in the plate and pay. And let's say Portland General is willing to pay, but not PacifiCorp. I'm not talking that. I'm just making a hypothetical. So let's just say we've got 60% of the water heaters represented by utilities that want to do it, and 40% that say, I'm not so sure. So it could be that we prorated, BPA and PGE and the others that say yes, pay not $20 but $30, right? So that we still unlock, so we get every water heater in the Northwest to have the socket. But all I would say is fair. For the money I sunk on behalf of other people, when they recognize the benefit, then I would want them to pay me back for the money I sunk ahead of time, just at cost. I don't need it to be anything more than at cost. And for those that never do it, that's fine too, because there's so much benefit for those that say yes. If I have the carrying costs only paid for by, two-thirds of the utilities, it's still going to be wildly economic. It's just the locking is a way to make those that want to be free, the utilities that want to be free riders, eventually pay their fair share. Mm. It's just a concept. There might be better ways to do
that. Sounds like the difference between getting Wi-Fi for free if you're a Gold Hilton customer and having to pay $12.
No, it's just...
you have to pay to get...
It could be that BPA could control them for a utility and capture all the benefits. I mean, they can trade the megawatts, they can do the balancing.
Or they could be standard.
And they could control them. They could go directly to the customers through the aggregator, and the utilities don't have to pay a penny because BPA can derive all the benefits. Those details of the business model are what I mean as a project for, the coming year to figure out who benefits, and that there's more than enough benefits for everybody to win.
I was wondering about the interface, the module you plug it in.
Yeah.
And so is that then hooked into your power line to communicate then? Is that the model?
That's one model. The point is, I also mentioned direct FM here. I didn't make the point that...
Is that like for the West Mesh Network?
type.
It could be a mesh network. Whatever you want to stick in that hole that links you to a utility, you can.
Okay, so
that's your choice.
You know, the USB model and then it
now USB is a communication device.
Okay, so somehow you're communicating.
It can be. It could be an AMI system. It can be a pager system. It can be internet. It could be FM direct broadcast with one way.
So I have no idea how hot water heaters work. You provided a great chart that started my understanding. But if you could deepen my understanding a little bit more. So if we have load that we need to ramp up at 3 a.m.
Right.
because of wind, how long can this hot water heater act as a battery, and how long does it keep the water in there hot? You know, I assume we don't have 24 hours.
Well, normally a water heater is hot around the clock, and it's and because of it, it has actually more thermal losses at the bottom here because it's always hot. It'll actually reduce energy losses at the bottom by keeping it cold. But to get to your point is, what's happening here is you take that load shape of when people actually use hot water, and you're going to derive the number of megawatt hours of backlog of heat, essentially. And so that at the back office application, you're keeping track of how, just because of normal usage, and you'll calibrate it with cold water temperature. So while we look like for wind and solar and, you know, all school days to determine forecast for a mountain, now we're going to look at cold water inlet temperatures. And that will be part of our forecast tool. So that'll tell you how many megawatt hours remain to be charged. And if you turn it on and off during the day, you have a little calculator there that knows it's coming on at 4,500 watts, and you just subtract
If your question is how long can this continue to take a full load, it's 6.4, from what we have here, it's 6.4 kilowatt hours divided by 4,500 watts.
You have the
about an hour and a half.
If you kept it on at full power.
No, but that's what he's asking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
If you wanted to put it all into 1 hour, you'd have a limitation.
For an hour and a half, but how long... From the customer's perspective, from the hot water user's perspective, so let's say I'm not home.
Uh-huh.
At what point does that benefit disappear?
So there is no, in this water heater, I am not, there's no mixing valve, there's no superheating.
Yeah.
That could be an option we add later. But the point is, once it gets hot, there is no more benefit.
His point is, he's out of the house.
Right.
And he's taking this extra energy into the hot water heater. It's going to be a couple, 3 days, actually, I expect. I actually can do this, but not in my head. There will be standby losses because you've heated the water up, and that will eventually take the lower part of the tank to ambient again.
Right. When I go on vacation for more than like 5 days, I turn my water heater off. To save energy.
No one else does.
Okay, I know.
I'm sorry. Okay.
As a customer, continue to do that, whatever you do, if that saves. Otherwise, you're paying constantly to keep your water hot, and this doesn't change what you pay. And this doesn't use any more energy than you would. It actually uses a little bit less.
Conrad, Smart Energy Profile 2, does it do the same thing as this?
So, Smart Energy Profile 2 is an application for how you send a command to the water heater. The only command I'm using in this is on and off. Nothing more. On, off. And SEP supports that. CEA supports that. OpenADR supports that. So the application that you send over this really doesn't matter. And you can choose any of them.
Can you manipulate between the elements? If you have two elements, can you decide which one you're going to use?
In the model that I'm here, I'm constantly keeping the top third hot, and I'm not, because I don't want the customer to run out of hot water.
Do you put that on local temperature control in the water heater?
It'll be whatever the customer sets it at. And all I'm doing is playing with the bottom element.
Conrad, can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Back on your communication path slide, I think it's one.
Oops.
Yeah, this one. So, which path do you think is more likely? I've kind of come to the conclusion that the through-the-meter path that everybody was pushing real hard for may not be the most likely path.
Well, I knew that in 2005 when I wrote my business case. And so our meters don't have any option for that path. We could exchange a meter out if a customer really wanted it, and we could create that path. But from all my experience, I knew that was going to fail miserably and be totally uneconomic, just like California and Texas have discovered. So Wi-Fi is very likely, but in the rural areas, we probably still would use our AMI system. And for customers that want privacy, FM Direct is likely to be an option as well.
Okay, thanks.
Actually, I should tell people on the phones, we've got a sound system guy here that's got another thing, and he's being patient, but we may have to cut the phones before too long. We may continue the discussion here in the room. So if someone on the phone has a question right now, they should ask it, because I won't guarantee how much longer we keep the phones, okay? Any other questions from the phone guys?
That's all I
had. Okay. All right, thanks.
Conrad, first, applaud your effort on this. I think it's very interesting, and great job looking at this. Question for you would be, what about the risk as far as increasing the temperature in the water heater? Is there any risk you feel on the utility side from worrying about that?
Not doing
as it. I said, I'm not doing that in this model. Not doing any additional heating. All I'm doing is reheating it to whatever the customer wants is the temperature.
The risk is that the customer is going to want a big bath, and the hot water won't be there because you're only keeping it hot.
That's where the smart water heater actually gets in. Yeah. The algorithm, there's a lot of subtleties here that I haven't gone into. But if, like, a household has, I've done this model more as if everybody takes showers in the morning, but that's not actually true. It's just easier to contemplate that model. There's a group that has dual peaking, you know, they got a family and they take a bunch in the morning. So you've got to recharge the tank fully before that evening peak. Or if that's when they peak, you got to recharge. And there's some smarts in the water heater that learn that and do that for you. What that does, though, is if you have another evening, if you have dual peaks, you're still going to have you'll actually have more cold water to recharge than you do. It gets a conflict, but you actually have more in larger houses. You actually have more benefits.
I still believe that the risk is if somebody does. If normally they take morning showers, and then for some reason they break their habit, and somebody takes an evening shower or bath, there's more risk that they'll run out of hot water.
There is more risk. You're absolutely right. That's why we're paying them some money. There is an override, and we could keep track of how many overrides people are doing, but you have to go to the water heater locally. Actually, you could be done over the web. Or a smartphone. So if you knew you were going to have more event, you could do the override. And that will all work into the statistics of it will decrease the potential slightly. But people don't override as a rule. I mean, that we learned that in existing DR programs. And so anything that makes it better for customers, you're going to do. And it's still going to be a hell of a bargain.
So going back to the heat pump water heater, are you assuming that what mode of operation are you assuming for the heat pump water heaters?
I'm assuming that it's operating in whatever it should operate in.
Well, you assumed it was a 300 watt load instead of a 600. So you're assuming it's in heat pump. It's not in resistance.
Okay. So I mean, but it might be in. It's really the recharging of the bottom tank. I don't. One of my research bullets here. Whoops. I did it wrong. Where's the little? How do I? F5. Oh, that doesn't matter. So, it's the last slide, naturally. So, I mean, the best control strategy for a heat pump water heater. I was talking to Ryan yesterday. We were all in Austin. Lee came back early, but. I mean, he's talking about, and some of the things Nia's working on, with the more advanced heat pumps. And if you go to a variable speed compressor, a variable speed drive for the compressor, then you would probably just be scaling that up and down. And as opposed to, the point is the best way to control heat pump water, I'm not really certain. I haven't played with them enough. I've played with electric resistors for a long time, but it can be done. And especially if there's a larger tank, you have a lot of flexibility. It's just, I'm not sure you can cycle them. There may be minimum run times and maximum, well, there won't be maximum, but there'll be a minimum run time for compressors. That could be a little bit of a problem at the very low end.
I visualize what you're saying is we could program our heat pumps the way we do our furnace, or the way we imagine our EVs, that you can program it so that it heats in the middle of the night for your morning showers, and then it heats in the middle of the day when not everybody is doing stuff, so that at the end of the day when everybody comes home, you have heat.
Yeah, I mean,
and you're not at risk of having a cold bath.
There'll be an algorithm, and there'll be heat pump. I mean, there's firmware and there's logic in the heat pump water heater, as well as the resistance. Now that going to electronic control, to put in smarts and to put in sort of customer typical patterns. But as was mentioned, there are going to be times when the typical patterns don't happen, and you're going to have to override or let somehow the water heater know that you have an unusual use.
We've drained the group. Okay, good. Well, I'm not going to hold you. I had another thing that actually was related to heat pump water heaters and resistance water heaters and DR and efficiency. It'll be posted. I'm not going to do it. Relax. It'll be posted, and if I think it might kind of stand on its own. That isn't how I usually make PowerPoints, but if you have any questions about it, you can give me a call. Up until March 15th. and I'll be glad to talk about it because it's an interesting thing about DOE being asked to waive the heat pump requirement for big hot water heaters in certain cases, and what the argument is that they should be able to do that or not, and what the trade-offs are. We're back to, trade-offs between efficiency and DR. So that's my pitch about that. It's kind of interesting. And we are, yeah?
I was going to answer your last bullet point there on the bike cost.
Oh.
So you asked about what are the avoided costs for slice customers, and I'm just going to say if your loads are growing and you forecast a need for new capacity, then it's going to be whatever the least cost capacity additions.
Out in the market.
Well, whether it's a CT or out in the market or whatever.
Yeah, okay.
If your loads aren't growing, then it's just the market values of capacity in the region, which are currently very low.
Well, I've been told zero.
It's not that low, but
no, sure. I didn't think it was that. So, we're probably not going to get to this issue. But the reason I was interested in it was because it strikes me I'd like to understand what the incentives are for slicers to do DR. They've got a different situation. Thank you all for coming. Really, it's been a lot of fun working with this group. If I don't work with it anymore, I have really enjoyed it up till now.
And it's been great to work with you.